Morning.
Good morning.
I want to bring to order the regular board meeting of Forest Practices Board on this day of November 14, 2018. And to start off with, I'd like Patricia to do our safety briefing, please.
Good morning and welcome to the Natural Resources Building. In the event of a fire, alarms will sound and flash. In the event of an earthquake, alarms may not sound and flash. Please drop to the floor and cover your head or go under the table. In any evacuation of the building, staff will lead you out of the building using the double doors in the front of the room. Then the first door on the left, moving east towards the grass area along Jefferson Street. There, DNR employees are trained and equipped to assist you in checking in and responding to any emergencies you may have. At this time, I ask you silence any noise-making devices. Thank you.
Okay. Ben, would you lead off in introducing your board members, please?
My name is Ben Sir. I'm the director designee from the Washington State Department of Commerce.
Lisa Janicki, representing the counties.
Good morning, I'm Dave Pereira. I'm a general public member.
Carmen Smith, representing Contract Loggers.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Cyril Thomas Laurie, representing Department of Ecology.
Good morning. I'm Stephen Bernath. I'm the Commissioner of Public Lands Designee.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Jeff Davis. I'm the Department of Fish and Wildlife Designee.
Good morning. My name is Tom Nelson. I'm a public member.
Good morning. My name is Patrick Apper. I'm the Director's Designee for the Department of Agriculture.
Hello, I'm Bob Gunther, public member.
And staff, please. Introduce yourself.
Good morning. I'm Joe Schramnick, DNR Forest Practices Division Manager.
Bill Ferrister, Attorney General's Office.
Good morning. Mark Engel, Assistant Division Manager, Forest Practices.
Trish Anderson, Rules Coordinator for the Forest Practices Board.
Okay. Thank you. I want to kick off with the report from the chair. First item I wanted to speak to is sort of an update on the Cultural Resources Project. That, as you know, I've been working with the landowners and tribes and the state on. We had a meeting on November 1st, which was well attended, and we are not done. And we are going to be, there should be a letter going out soon to all the people that attended and others to identify next steps. And I don't have much more than that. What we're trying to do is get to closure so that we can decide whether we're going to put something in front of the legislature, and time is real short on that now. The second thing I wanted to mention is, as you can imagine, all the state agencies have put in budgets. They had to do that in September, and now we're working, letting stakeholders know what all our budgets are. And I will just say a couple of things. I will, later in the day, I'll have our budget packages on the back table available to folks. But DNR has put out three large buckets of packages. One is around wildfire and forest health, as you know, and have probably heard, if you've heard the commissioner speak recently. We had about 1,800 wildfire starts this year and burned about 350,000 acres. The good news about that is that it was more wildfire starts than we've ever had before, but we burned fewer acres this year because of changes in strategies that we've put forward. And so our budget request is a combo of treating forest health issues along with having some budget requests that would help underpin the strategies we are undertaking that seem to be a little bit more successful. We also have rural and community, rural communities and trust health package, which is around state lands more than anything, although it includes things about outdoor recreation. But the idea is to do some investment that will provide some long-term return to the trustees over time. And then the final package we have is the environment and resilience, which is a combo of salmon-focused things as well as forest practices, which are also salmon-focused, obviously. And I'll just mention a few of the forest practices pieces that this board may be interested in. We are asking for additional FTEs in our small forest landowner office. As you know, when the recession hit, that office got cleaned out to a minimum of two FTEs, and we've been surviving on that. We have about 178,000 small forest landowners with more than 20 acres out there, and it's very hard to serve their needs. So we're asking for four foresters and one communication specialist to help us do that work. We also continue to be up to our eyeballs on working on unstable slopes issues, and so we're asking for a couple of additional FTEs to manage that workload so that we do a good job in reviewing applications that are on or around potentially unstable slopes and do it within the 30 days. We also have a request to update FPARS. That system is going on 20 years old, and we want to take advantage of current technology, including mobile devices and so forth. And hopefully it will also make it easier for applicants to submit their applications, electronically sign them, and electronically pay for their permit fees. And finally, the three capital budgets that I want to focus on is triple F2P. We're asking for $20 million. It'll be the biggest ask we've ever had. We think that fits in with the parka and salmon strategy that everybody was talking about. That would buy us another 160 culverts on small landowner land. FREP program, we're asking for 17.3. We've been encouraged by members of the legislature to take care of the backlog on FREP. And so that number represents the backlog plus what we expect to see in the next 2 years. And then the Riparian Rivers Habitat Open Space Program, which both puts perpetual conservation easements on CMZs and all in Muirlet Habitat. We're asking for $6 million. So I just wanted to mention that in passing, and we'll have more information on our budget packages for you later in the day. So, is Karen Terwilliger in the room? No? Okay. Well, I wanted to take this opportunity to, I don't know how many of you know, but Karen is going to be retiring at the end of the year. And I thought the board should take this opportunity to thank her for all the good work she's done representing her caucus at the TFW policy table. And she has certainly been in front of us many times over the past 6 years. So I just, let's offer her some congratulations.
She said she was going to show up later to say, see you suckers. So.
The other thing that I wanted to point out is Karen's replacement has been identified already, and Darren, you want to raise your hand. And I'm sure we'll hear from him instead today, I guess, I assume. As you know, Darren has a long history with DNR, and we're looking forward to working with him in his new role. Finally, I wanted to just mention, because several of you regularly ask me about this, and that's about an update on the audits. So our internal audit was working on the financial audit, and then she took a promotion to Department of Revenue, so it didn't quite get done. So we're looking forward to hiring a new auditor and having them pick up from there on that. And I'm still awaiting the state auditor's office commitment to doing a performance audit in 2019. I haven't heard back from them yet. At this time, what I'd like to do is entertain public comment both on general board issues and any comments that people would like, the public would like to provide regarding yesterday's field tour.
Oh, are you doing the field tour?
But you got them separate?
Yes.
Oh, let's do general public comment first.
Okay. No others.
Jim Peters.
Good morning. My name is Jim Peters, representing Northwest Indian Fish Commission, Western Washington Tribes. Some of the agencies have been waiting for this, and it's an honor for me to be able to present this in front of you. But this is the tribal habitat strategy that we've been working on for a couple of years now, and so I just wanted to make a couple comments on this, and you guys can review it. And also, this document, along with some other stuff, videos pertaining to our habitat strategy, is online, and you can look that up also. So I'll start off as quoting somebody: "As the salmon disappear, so do our culture and treaty rights. We are at a crossroads and we are running out of time." These words are from the late tribal leader, Billy Frank Jr. He basically wanted to make sure that people understood how closely the salmon resource and the water and the environment is important to the tribes. Despite the cuts of harvest, both on tribal and non-tribal harvest, and restriction on hatcheries, strategy on hatcheries and dealing with that, and then a lot of financial investment on habitat, salmon resources continue to decline. We call this habitat strategy Quadatus. It's an approach to identify and protect lands, waters, ecology processes critical to our rights and resources and homeland. The translation from Lusutsi Aquatics means teaching of our ancestors. It acknowledges our beliefs, our teachings are learned within our homelands, which can never be separated from tribal cultural and heritage. It asserts that we have traditional ways of protecting the lands and the water that sustain us. This is something that has to be, it's going to be a unified approach, and this is designed to organize and focus work around common landscape-based objectives and protecting tribal treaty rights and resources. It's going to be focusing on preserving and restoring the processes and functions of riverine, marine, terrestrial ecosystems. The work will be requiring coordination and accountability across agencies, including regulatory and enforcement authorities. It also will require transparent accounting of habitat conditions. We're all a part of this strategy as we're setting up mapping system, and as things in our watersheds are looking at and either recovering or important habitat is being taken away, basically based on development or land use type of process, we'll be able to track where we're going. This isn't a process of going back, you know, 200 years from now and getting conditions that way. The purpose of this is actually looking at and understanding what is needed out on the landscape and then finding out what is out on the landscape. So where we can, where we know where the gaps are in the watersheds that need to be focused on this. So in our plan, we have some key targets that we're looking at. And this is our tribal perspective, and we're hoping as we get this out that we're gonna work with the state agencies to go through this. But the key targets that we have, Pacific Ocean, it's pretty broad. But you know, there's a lot of issues going out there and stuff. Near shore is another one. We're losing habitat on the near shore that's important for our forage fish ecosystems and things like that. Floodplains, you know, we have a lot of our floodplains in some of these areas that are disconnected and causing some issues. Riparian, we all know about that, and then also water. And so we have goals, indicators, and initiating tasks that we have laid out. This is something that the tribes felt pretty strongly about, and it goes back to our treaty rights at risk paper that we did, where you know, we have so many agencies trying to do the right thing, but we're kind of doing this flyby with each other. And we need to coordinate a lot of different things under a lot of different jurisdictions. We have the counties that have certain jurisdiction and authorities to deal with critical ordinances and things like that. We have state agencies that are responsible for water, state agencies responsible for fish and wildlife. And we just need to get on the same page and understand where we need to go to get the fish returning and using all the habitat that is should be available to them, and not just the segments that are regulated. And in the forestry industry, we are the only ones that are doing the right things. And we're continuing to try to educate ourselves to continue to do the right things as time and as technology comes in front of us. So thank you very much. And if you have any questions.
Thank you, Jim. All right. I think what I'm gonna do is let's go to approval of minutes. And then we'll take public comment on the field tour yesterday after that. So are there any edits or concerns with the minutes that were sent?
Mr. Chair, I move that we approve the minutes for August 8th, 2018 as presented.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Board Member Herrera seconds the motion. Any discussion? No discussion. All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries. Thank you. All right. Patricia, public comment on the field tour, please. Elaine O'Neill.
Chairman Burnett and members of the board. I'm Dr. Elaine O'Neill, Executive Director of the Washington Farm Forestry Association, Small Forest Landowners. You should all have a nice little double page that I handed over to Patricia. Do you have that?
I'm getting it.
No.
I was working on the principle that a picture is worth a thousand words. First off, I'd like to personally thank you for your willingness to take Ken's offer of a tour of his tree farm yesterday. It's really important, I think, to have a visual perspective of the kinds of elements in our proposal and the WFFA riparian template proposal. I just want to reiterate a couple things Ken talked about in terms of the fish streams. There's really three site-specific conditions for the fish streams in our proposal. It's over 15 feet, 5 to 15 feet, and less than 5 feet. Now, I know that looking at his stand and imagining how a 25-foot buffer on a less than 5-foot stream would suffice is pretty difficult. So I wanted to give you some more visuals to augment what Ken demonstrated yesterday. So this is an example of a candidate stream. And based on physical defaults, this is a fish stream. Even though we tend to think of stream as water, this fish stream doesn't actually have water from May to October. It's less than 5 feet wide. If you look closely, there is a channel that's between 1 and 2 feet wide. It disappears on flatter ground. The slope brink, if you look at this first picture, is about 25 feet from bank full width, but it goes in and out like this. If you look closely, the deciduous canopy is falling apart. I had to put the red lines in case you said, well, this is just a random picture of a forest. Yeah, it is under there. I had to dig to find the bank full width, but it's there. If you turn that over, you can see that there were conifers there at one time. There's some big old high-cut stumps of Douglas fir and even the springboard notches in the western red cedar. I doubt there's been much conifer there for the last 100 years. In any case, it would have been mixed conifers, pretty widely spaced. So when you think about options, conifer restoration might be an option, but you certainly wouldn't get it near the stream, and I would say the risk of failure is high. That's because I have an incredibly high population of black-tailed deer there. They're so popular or so common, they won't even get off the road when you drive by. That means if you want to do a conifer restoration, not only do you have difficulty with restoration in terms of brush, but you have problems with browse and the attendant costs that are associated with that. So the point being that this kind of stream fits perfectly into that less than 5 foot candidate. In all likelihood, doing a conifer restoration is probably low priority. It would grow really good alder. But I'd say without management, it's going to go on its current trajectory of falling apart and becoming a brush field. So that I wanted to give that as some visuals for you to have a look at and think about to augment what Ken talked about yesterday, and I'll take any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
Eric Musselman.
I'm president of the Washington Farm Forestry Association, and I just wanted to add my thanks to what Elaine said for your taking the time to come and visit our Western Washington template demonstration tree farm yesterday. As you can see, a lot of care for the water resources of Washington went into the planning, while at the same time offering smaller buffers for smaller harvests that small forest landowners of Washington were promised in forest and fish. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and if you have any comments, I'll address them.
Thank you, Derek.
Thank you.
Jim Miller.
Good morning, Chairman Bernath and members of the board. Thank you again. I just wanted to stress some visuals that we saw yesterday, go through a little review. First one is board member Janicki raised a question about template, you know, and that confusion. I don't have really time to go into much detail there, but from our viewpoint, the proposal that we brought forward with all the science could have easily just been a rule, which we would have been much happier with. But the template provides greater assurance and less risk for the other stakeholders, so we thought that it would be a little easier lift. So, but we can go into more detail on that at another time. Other thing that Elaine kind of touched on, our blue tarp that we put out there, that was representing bank full width, and the actual water that is in there is significantly less than that in most cases, so that might have been a perception that was not quite right. And I also want to point out that forests and fish is about protecting functions. In fact, the chair coined the phrase a number of years ago when we were doing the alternate plan guidance, functions are us, and that's really what it's all about. But they did so in a shared risk paradigm that also protects tries to protect clean water, harvestable salmon, aquatic critters, and economic viability, with some deference to smalls because of the disproportionate impact and the small business economic impact statement. Regardless of how effective our actual negotiated current rules are, the approval standard is about effectiveness relative to the existing rules. Our science that we provided, review of our science, said that in general, at least the 50-foot and wider buffers provided 95% in round numbers, 95% as effective as the current rules. We have now had an independent science review of the same proposals, who came to essentially the same answer. On the 50 foot and wider, roughly 95% is the same effectiveness as the current rules. Some little questions, a little more risk on the 25 foot buffer. We also had a very and I would say the remaining 5% from our viewpoint is covered by our smallness on the landscape and the relatively low impact intent of the legislature. We also, Mark Engel talked yesterday morning about we had numerous similar alternate plans on the landscape by small landowners since the passing of forests and fish. And quite a number of those were reviewed after harvest by ID teams, professionals. They found a couple of operational issues that we can deal with pretty easily. But when it came to looking at the functions, almost all of the sites that they went to rated an A for functions. And those alternate plans had similar no-touch buffers. They averaged somewhere between 40 and 50 feet, depending on the stream width. So this was a big lift for us. You know, putting this proposal together in 2005 for our small organization, we wanted to try to do it right. We'd had several efforts in the prior to that that, you know, we process fouls and we weren't coming at it right. This was in fact, we've been told this is probably the very best, most complete proposal initiation to ever come before this board. But it's also a big lift for you folks to think of in terms of functions, not the visual of how much narrower our proposed buffers are than what the current rule is. It's about functions. There's a lot of disincentives to small forest landowners keeping forest land forested beyond the emotions and public benefits that I tried to share in the poem that I read yesterday.
there's also a lot more at stake than the prescriptions themselves. It's about honoring your forest and fish commitments, honoring science, honoring the small business economic impact determinations, honoring the ID team conclusions of after harvest on similar harvests. In the TFW policy arena, we've had recently one very good conversation about one of the prescriptions. It was very collaborative and it was very encouraging. There's a lot of sharing that went on. We didn't take a vote. We didn't reach any conclusions, but it was just a wonderful, wonderful conversation. And we had several more of those conversations to go forward. And it's about understanding the ask. It's about understanding what the concerns are and having a brainstorming collaborative conversation about how we can address those concerns. So we're really looking forward to those. The tour yesterday kind of helped open that dialogue with some of your questions, and we appreciate that very much. We are open to alternative pathways within the context of our proposal, but at the end of the day, we must find a way for a meaningful yes. And I would be happy to take questions now or when you get into the general board discussion. And we would love to meet with all of you individually about any concerns that you might have. We're ready to get down, knuckle down, and try to get this thing back to you guys by the end.
So, Member Gunther?
So, Ken, and Elaine presented these pictures to us. And if you look at the first picture on the left here, what would be your vision of restoration of that draw rather than letting it become a brush patch?
As I understand it, I have not seen that site. It's essentially a hardwood site, and I think Elaine said it would be really difficult to get conifer back in there. One of our other members that was there yesterday has an all hardwood site. So you just have to, from my viewpoint, you just have to accept that this is going to be a hardwood site, and also recognize that at some point in time, it's going to drop out. So we have to, and it's not part of our template proposal in a big way, but we have to find a way to address the imminent mortality of hardwood stands so that we can find a way to manage harvest, do some small scale harvest in hardwood stands, which means a regeneration harvest. But we've got to find a way to do so that it doesn't impact the functions. But that one, from my understanding, is it's going to be hardwood, so you might as well manage it for hardwoods. You'll never reach DFC without doing something. And in pure hardwood stands, you never will really reach DFC permanently, because you're not going to have 200-year-old, 140-year-old hardwoods in there. I don't know if anybody noticed when we drove into the park, the first bridge that we came to, there was conifer on one side of the stream. The other side of the stream was hardwood. It's given up. It's 80, 90 years old. It's given up. So the functions that those trees were providing are going to disappear, and it's going to be replaced with just exactly what you see in the photos there from Elaine's house.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.
Peter Goldman, please.
Good morning. I'm Peter Goldman, Washington Forest Law Center. I'm speaking for the center today, not my colleagues. I'm sorry I didn't make the field trip yesterday to Ken's, although I've been out there before. And I want to thank Ken for his tireless advocacy on behalf of small forest landowners. I want to just say that on behalf of the conservation community, we recognize that small forest landowners are a really major part of the picture. We're not unmindful to that at all. What we are very concerned about is sort of regulatory rollbacks on a template basis rather than on a site-specific basis, where we can really assess function on a site. Small forest landowners, the issues facing them are massive. It's not easy, and when you don't have family members who want to work the tree farm, when you have developers offering $50,000 to $60,000 an acre when your trees are maybe worth $5 to $10,000, when there are technical challenges, tax issues, generational issues, as I just said. It's a formidable, and with Growth Management Act not really functioning in those areas, it's a formidable challenge, and we recognize that. But again, we don't think regulatory rollbacks are the way to go. We think site-specific alternate plans, which were in the forest and fish proposal, were there. We think that we're really excited to hear that DNR is asking for more budget positions in the Small Forest Landowner Office. In my view, small forest landowners should have free technical assistance in submitting alternative plans. We should streamline that process as much as possible. We agree with the riparian easement program. I'd be first in line to testify at the legislature as far as tax policy to keep folks in the landscape, to incentivize them, whether it be tax exemption from property taxes or their forest products. I know that there are groups that will do free Forest Stewardship Council assessments, NNRG, Northwest Natural Resource Group. So I guess I just hope that this doesn't become sort of a vote on whether we care about small forest landowners, because we all do. It's just we think regulatory rollbacks are not the way to go. It really needs to be site-specific, and we really can do a lot more working together on the more, so on the set of larger policies to keep these folks in the landscape. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Okay, so what I'd like to do is entertain a board discussion, but before we start that, Mark's gonna step you, there's some day of packet information in front of you. We thought it would be helpful today to actually give you a copy of the riparian rules as they are, and since this is a west side template, we're only showing you the west side tables, and then also hand you the board manual for alternate plans. There were a lot of numbers being thrown around yesterday, and we just wanted to make sure you knew what the baseline is. Mark?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I'm Mark Engel, Assistant Division Manager for Policy Services Forest Practices. Not to go through the detail of all of the handouts, but just to let you know what you received today, because there were an awful lot of numbers yesterday, and it's really hard to keep track of everything when you're trying to learn about a proposed template as well as keep track of the current rules and the current templates. So what we've provided today is, the alternate plan rules, which does state that alternate plans as a general, both large and small forest landowners or any landowner can submit an alternate plan. And just to emphasize, it does state that when an alternate plan is received, that there will be an ID team called. That was to clarify confusion yesterday morning. The intent with the template is that an ID team may be called, but it's not mandatory. And again, templates are those prescriptions that are so frequently used that it could be expected that landowners, given a form as prepared by the Forest Practices Program, they can fill out the form, attach that to the FPA, and they have an alternate plan as a template. The next thing is that there was a lot of information being given about this template is for Western Washington, and there was a lot of talk about what the standards are, the metrics are for the both the Type F rules as well as the NP rule in RMZ buffers. So you have been given the rules that show you what the dimensions are for both F waters as well as M waters. In addition to that, we talked about forest practice applications and what are the total number and then what percent of those are alternate plans. I do have those numbers today from 2009 through 2015. It's the data that we had readily available. there were 9,700 FPAs, a little slightly more than 9,700 FPAs submitted by small forest landowners in that time frame. Of those, 533 were for alternate plans, which is 18% of the total FPAs submitted by small forest landowners. And of the 533, three quarters of those were templates. So that kind of clarifies the use of templates are frequently used for alternate plans, and you know, slightly less than 20% of FPAs. This is based on past have been alternate plans.
Can you say the percentage of the alternate plans that were alternate plan templates again?
About three quarters of the 533. And then the last thing that we've given out is Board Manual Section 21. It's the guidelines for alternate plans. This section is written for small forest landowners. It, because of what we talked about, is most of the section. We've given you the entire section. The very first part of the section in part 1.1 is a fairly detailed discussion on all of the riparian function, including it talks about what each function is, it talks about the area of influence, and then it gives information on how to achieve each function. So it's a very good reference to kind of understand the direction that's already been board approved to be provided to small forest landowners. And then beginning on page M21-9, or page 9 of this section, is template 1, the first template the board approved. That's the overstock template, stand template. The original intent of this template was the fact that prior to Forest and Fish, forest landowners cut to a different RMZ width. There was an investment made by all forest landowners, including smalls, into regeneration. Now we have wider buffers, and what we found was that they had, regeneration planted within the RMZ. So in order to capture some of that investment and to enhance that stand to meet DFC, the board approved the overstock stand template. That way, when those trees reach commercial age, they can go in one-time entry to thin them out and leave them in a position to reach DFC faster and allow the small forest landowner to capture profit from that investment. The second template is on page 15. That's the fixed width for riparian management zone template. Just to point out really quickly, that template was laid out yesterday, very last page. It is by site class, the width. And as you see, Ken stated that his site would be a site class 3. And if you look in the box, it does say 101 feet. That's where the 101 feet came.
Great, thank you. Mark, any questions for Mark? Okay, so first of all, I want to thank Ken and Bonnie Yaller again for hosting the field tour yesterday. And really appreciate that. I'm personally looking forward to getting the ISPR review of the science underpinning the list site template to see what it's going to say. And then what I'd like to do is just open it up to board members to see what your reflections on yesterday's field tour are. Bob, you look like.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to go out and see, because I think that so many times looking at the process or looking at the proposal is a lot better. And when we talk about regulation rollbacks, which was just testified to, sometimes there are regulation rollbacks, but in this case I see, from what I saw yesterday, the opportunity to enhance, I believe, the five functions. And without that oversight to enhance those from the DNR, to enhance those functions, we don't have a game. In other words, the small landowners aren't going to be able to do the prescriptions that was described yesterday. So I think the oversight's there, and I don't look at it as a regulation rollback. I look at what I saw yesterday as an opportunity for the small forest landowners to be able to harvest a few more trees and at the same time enhance the functions. Why would we, in Elaine's pictures here, from my opinion, if 100 feet back doesn't do anything for that small stream, why would we let those trees not be harvested if the functions aren't, in question? So I think the science will show that, and from what I've heard from Ken and the small forest landowners, I think they're making a really honest effort to maintain the five functions.
Other board members? Board member
Nelson.
I just want to add
a get there.
Too many trips around the sun, I think. I just wanted to talk about the approval standard. The approval standard that's in the alternate plans, to me, is a big hang-up for the small landowner assemblies, because in all cases, the alternate plan has to have protection that's at least equal in the as those in the existing rules. But there's a nifty little phrase that was plugged in there by someone long before me that says, to the protection provided in the Act and the rules. And to me, this is where it's really going to come down to. I don't think you can make a strong case to the ISPR that going from a 50-foot no-cut buffer to a 25 is equal protection on the surface. But I think when you look at it in totality, that the cumulative effect of these rules on small landowners is really, you're talking about the risk and the potential for a change in land use. And I think that has to be incorporated in here as we deliver this. It's more of a policy question, but you could keep the same 300-foot swath on that stream that Elaine showed us this morning by selling the land, having it developed, putting it into the critical areas ordinance of the county, and yeah, you'll still have the 300 feet, but you're going to have one or more houses and a septic system and two dogs and a cat there instead of having what you had as a forest. So I think somehow it isn't just the science of a 50-foot versus a 25-foot buffer. In the end, we're going to have to consider the change in land use that could come about from some of these activities. So I just throw that comment out.
Other board member reflections on yesterday's good trips? Board member Davis.
So I think it's human nature. We have a tendency to like talk about things that are in a black and white world, and I'm not sure we're talking about something that's black and white. My question is, not having the small forest landowner ownership data in front of us, I'm seeing like hard working good stewards and that own tree farms pushing this, knowing that, at least in my head, I have that they're 10% maybe of the small forest landowners that we're documenting as small forest landowners across the landscape, right? And when I say that, we have people that are managing tree farms for the stewardship and for economics as a legacy. And then we have folks like myself, if I go buy a 5-acre parcel that has a cabin and some trees, I'm considered a small forest landowner. And I may do one harvest in my whole life, and it may have different needs. And so I'm just wondering if it would be helpful. I know it would be for myself to have some information about who are the small forest landowners and what percent are we really talking about in this proposal, so that we can have a little scope and scale when we think about this. Because if, for me, you could go all the way to, okay, small forest landowners combined are larger than the forest industry. So if we're talking about something that I think the science might challenge the proposal as it's been thought of to date, but looking at that being every small forest landowner, if I just create that perception in my head, I might react very differently than if we're really talking about some rules for the small percent of small forest landowners that are actually tree farmers, right? So I don't know if anyone else feels like having that kind of information might help us understand the scope and scale of and potential effects of the proposal across the landscape. I appreciated what Ken said also, because I have a tendency to like reject the you can compartmentalize these biological and human systems, because they are connected downstream. And so knowing that our urban areas are dealing with affordable housing issues and things like that, Ken brought up transfer of development rights. Now I know that you can't deal with that in a template or an alternate plan, or maybe even rules at this board level or for DNR, but there's some, in my opinion, some potential for solving a lot of root cause problems out there if we just think about it as a system and figure out what part of the system can this create some solutions for.
Board Member Sweeney.
So these have been great comments so far, and I just wanted to add my thanks to Ken and Bonnie for having us out there. And I'm, I'm impressed with the amount of thought that's gone into the template, and also impressed with the fact that there's, there's a working group working on it, and policy's been spending a lot of time on it, and I can imagine that those conversations are not easy, but I've heard of some progress being made, and so in addition to what Board Member Davis just talked about, which I think is really important. I mean, thinking bigger picture, thinking really creatively, trying to figure out many pieces of the puzzle to help small forest landowners stay on the landscape, I think is a really good thing to do. But I also see, possibilities for something coming out of this process with the template, and it may not be the full proposal as originally envisioned. But I do think, and I've heard this from the technical folks, that there are things in there that that sound like they can work. And so the science review that's coming out of ISPR is going to be really important. And so I guess I just encourage, all of us as the board, but the folks also doing the hard work in the trenches about trying to bring something forward that we can vote on, to be, positive, hopeful, and creative. And so, yes, absolutely, the functions still need to be met, and we still need to work within the confines of the structure. I won't say confines, the structure of the rules and the law. But I think we can get there. I mean, I've heard enough, and seeing it on the ground is really helpful. And so, for us not to be too nervous about change, but also being good stewards as board members in terms of making sure that the process is done well, that the overall intent of the rules is met, but within that we can really dig deep and work with small forest landowners and find something that's going to provide them with the flexibility that they've been asking for. And it may be kind of like a little narrow path to get there, but I'm hopeful that we can.
Anybody over on the left side? Oh, sorry, I didn't mean that was unintended. Poor Member Smith.
I just want to echo what Tom and Bob said about trying to find something for the small forest landowners. My husband and I are contract loggers. We mostly work for big companies, but we do some small work. And lately we've been doing more and more estate stuff. So dad and mom buy the property, kids grow up, have their little cabins in the woods and tree forts that we find. Kids grow up, move away, mom and dad keep it. Hasn't been harvested since they were little and planted it themselves, the kids did, and mom and dad die, and they log it, they sell it. Sometimes it goes to somebody like Weyerhaeuser who will pick up a piece next to them, and a lot of times it gets turned into a development. It's, I know that if you choose to have your piece and go with DNR rules, it's totally different than if you go with county rules. So you can't touch it or develop it for 7 years, but what's 7 years when you can harvest so much more? So we have to find a way to, I hate to say the lesser of two evils, but we have to find a way to keep working for us working, otherwise it'd become a housing development.
I want to add my thanks. I've been out there now twice, and of course see things just a little bit differently, each time I'm there. The questions I asked in the field were real, in that the although you labeled it simplified, I didn't feel like the menu of choices and options was very simple. And I want to make sure that as we go down this route of template, it actually does apply where, you know, conditions are the same and it's not just a bypass to good forestry practices. Because I think, Ken, in the end, you know, your heart and soul is to create and maintain a healthy forest, and that part of it I absolutely respect, as our family also owns small farms, and I've been out and done some of the very work that you're doing. Your place looks a lot nicer than I feel like I need to be out there the woods a little more often, given what you've been able to accomplish on your site. So saving the smalls, whatever number they are. I remember being in Finland in 2005, and we did a big tour of, the northern up to Tampere, and looking and seeing where they said in that country. I don't remember what the population is, but they said there were over 400,000 separate landowners, and they all maintained their little plot of forest land. Themselves and the technology to go and gather up, harvest it. I mean, they were harvesting by hand and dragging the tractors to the roadside, and the equipment with the GPS would come and pick up, weigh, and self-load that. But they really connected with the ground. They understood it. And I agree with, some of the other board members here where we risk losing that. We are already losing that, the connection to the land. And I think that request for a communications coordinator in the small office is probably one of the most important positions that we could get going, because that story needs to be told as it's worthy of protection. As we walked away from Ken's demonstration and, some of my questions about how close can you really get to a riparian zone, I start getting, nervous about some of the falling a tree so close to the blue tarp. I did walk away and think, why isn't there, we need to be able to identify, special properties like the Millers where risk of development is so high and so real, and the pressures of building the next McMansion, in that setting would take down a forest and fund the buyout of those development rights. Yesterday I learned that you had 20 development rights on that piece of property, and I didn't know that. And I can see how that would, the temptation to convert that one would be real, and I think that would be a real loss to all of us. So I'm for balancing the economics, but actually I would like to see, a more aggressive path toward funding a buyout of development rights for willing landowners to keep those forests intact. As I know, I cannot predict what my own children will do, after I'm gone, and they too have worked on that land, but urbanization is happening.
Any Board Member Laurie.
Not to repeat all the comments, I've really appreciated this discussion, and I think I've agreed with everybody around the table. And as Carmen was pointing out, and Jeff, I think maybe a little bit larger discussion about this, and I think this was suggesting as well, on the small landowner world would be good for the board. Beginning with some of the information that Jeff was asking for, and maybe some lessons for us in how development rights work and whatnot. I don't want to lose sight of the template. I think that is the key. You know, and so a lot of hard work has gone on that. Really impressed with Mr. Miller's presentation at his property yesterday. He knows a lot. And it was just really great to see how fluent he is on this very difficult issue. And I certainly see the attraction of these fixed width buffers. So anyway, we want to keep focused on the template, but I think we have a bigger discussion that we could be having here that could be very beneficial. And I'm very interested in seeing what the science report comes back on the proposal. So, thanks.
Board Member Herrera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciated the tour yesterday and learning a little bit about small forest land. We were set down. You know, I don't work in the timber industry, and I'm certainly not a small forest landowner, so I appreciated that. And I appreciate the attempt to be creative, to try to get habitat functions protected and habitat functions restored. I think that we can't keep doing business the way we've done business for 100 years. So I listen to the small forest landowners. I also am working in a number of different forums, like the Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force, the Salmon Recovery Council, a bunch of other forums where we deal with a lot of interests as well, and including like agriculture, other small business. And I'm always struck by the fact that everybody wants to be held harmless. And we on the tribal side, many of us, many tribes don't get to fish hardly. And this is about restoring habitat function, protecting habitat function, so that the end game is we can have more salmon available to us. So in every one of the thousands, tens of thousands of tribal members who fish, at least in the Puget Sound, every one of them is a small business. So I don't want us to lose sight of, you know, we're working so hard for everybody else to be held harmless. And we're bearing the brunt of that right now. And so I want us to be creative so we can figure out how to change how we do business so that we can get to that end game. This is the same message I'm pushing in these other forums that I work in, and I'm really trying to connect that message in all the forums so that it leads to hopefully a broader look at how we do things. So I don't mean to get out of soapbox here, but I'm just struck by that. And one other thing about small forest landowners or any other business, you know, there's some, maybe many small forest landowners that aren't going to be here someday. And, you know, some lands will be converted, developed, but I mean, that's progress. And we have, you know, regulations and things that should govern how that development occurs so that we aren't having greater harm. I mean, some people invest in timber lands as
part of their nest egg. They want to retire someday and sell it for four or five times or more what they paid for housing or something else. So, I mean, I appreciate that, you know, people want to stay in business and continue to operate, but I'm really hoping we can be creative to find a way to A, not roll back protections, but also be creative to make it easier for small businesses and small forest landowners to continue to operate.
Mr. Chair,
I just want to add it.
Remember,
I just want to add my comments. I left and I went out the back way from Kansas, and I think it was a great example of the area to look at this because, you know, I just decided to go out the back way. I got lost and I finally got back on the right road. But if you go out from Kansas to the west, the first thing you hit when you leave this property is a golf course. And then you hit a subdivision that has about 80-foot lots on it with paved roads. So I can guarantee you that whether you're going to talk about a 50-foot zone, a 100-foot zone, a 101-foot zone, or a 25-foot zone, there are no zones once you take that land out of its current use and you put it into a golf course or a housing development. And that's the point I was trying to make.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to add to the discussion? Board member, sir.
I just want to thank the Millers for having us out. As a new board member, it was helpful for me to get out in the forest and take a look and kind of visualize what small forest landowners are facing. And so for me, that was really helpful. And so I appreciate the opportunity. And I think for me, this concern of land use conversion and a financial incentive to, you know, convert it to a different use is a big concern for me. I don't have an answer, but I appreciate the discussion around that. And, you know, I would like to see, one of the things I'm happy to hear is if there may be more support for small forest landowners, at least that request has been put forward. And I think providing those technical assistance solutions is really great. So thank you. Thanks to the Millers.
Davis.
I just want to clarify that development that you drove through was probably back in the 60s, 70s, or 80s. And so I do need to highlight that cities and counties actually do protect these critical areas. In some cases, we're accused of advocating for big dumb buffers. And so there's something to be said about how we navigate riparian areas now and moving forward so that they don't have to be viewed as a problem, but could be viewed as an asset beyond what they're intended to do, which is protect those critical areas and so that we can recover salmon and other fish and wildlife species and water quality and clean air, blah, 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 blah. So I just needed to highlight that what you drove through is one of those things that I think Board Member Herrera was talking about, where we have pretty good ordinances on the books today. We need to make sure that those are followed effectively, and we need to go back and do some restoration in the areas where they didn't have those protections in the past so that we can actually achieve, I think, what we're all gunning for here.
Board Member Gunther.
So I think Lisa brought up a real important point, and I think the communications person is, I'd like to echo, I think that's the most important position that you can fill, because the small forest landowners aren't, they need more communications from DNR on individual forest landowners. I think that's a great position.
Thank you. So I'm gonna try and sort of summarize what I, and add in my two cents, of course. So I thought this has been a good discussion. I believe the policy folks are supposed to be getting this all wrapped up by May, is that correct, Mark? And so what I would suggest to meet some of the suggestions by board members to understand more statistics. Perhaps we can look at the May meeting. May's going to be a big meeting anyway. So anyway, sometime May or the summer, we should have perhaps a work session around what does small landowners look like, you know, how many of them are there, how much do they harvest compared to large landowners, et cetera, to sort of set a context. But at the same time, we need to make sure water quality and fish habitat are protected. So putting that all together, and that's sort of our universe, the board's universe, on what we can affect. On some of the other concerns that were expressed around conversion and so forth, for those of you who were at the WFPA annual meeting, I mean, my boss, the Commissioner of Public Lands, made it really clear that avoided conversion is one of her priorities. And perhaps that's something, as we move forward towards a principles type discussion, that can be taken up. But that's really outside the context of this board to actually promote some legislation and come up with incentives to keep people on the land, whether it's through purchase or transfer development rights or some carbon in the post-1631 era now. I think there's opportunities to have a discussion about that and figure out how to move forward. So with that, I'll close that discussion, and perhaps what we can do is move into the next agenda item, which is, yes?
Can I just clarify?
Yes.
So on the smalls, the data?
Yes.
I would say, if it's at all possible in the data, to differentiate between my example where Jeff goes and buys a cabin in the woods, if that's at all possible, and that's like probably I didn't buy that property to log. I bought it for the cabin and the tree standing, but I may do like a one-time treatment, whether it to get to some economic value out of it, or to do a forest health treatment. That's, in my head, a little bit different than I bought this property to be a tree farmer, basically, right? And the economics around that are, in my mind, potentially different than the one time. And I don't know if the data can tease that apart, but I think that's important because I have this perception that most small forest landowners may not even know they're small forest landowners, versus the good folks that have been working on this template that know that that's why they got into it, right?
No, so that's definitely part of the picture we should be providing back.
Thank you.
Board Member Nelson.
Just to tag on to that, it would seem to me that we could go to the Department of Revenue, go back 4 or 5 years. We know what the gross acres are in the land category of small landowners. The acres and the volume harvested, it's going to be reflective of the lumber market, which has been up and down over the last 5 years. But if we go back a few years and take an average of the acres and or volume versus the gross acres, you can at least compare that to industrial landowners. And I think that's one of the things you're looking at. How many of the small landowners actually harvest timber, and what is that in relation to the effects of those that harvest annually?
So I had a little bit of a question on timing. And so I think this data that you guys are talking about would be very helpful. If policy is going to be wrapping things up by May, are we going to be making a decision in May, or are we going to be getting a presentation and then making a decision in August? And the reason I'm asking is I'm wondering if it would be helpful, if it's possible, to have this, you know, sort of broader discussion of painting a picture of small forest landowners in February instead of May, if we're going to be closer to a decision in May. So we kind of have time to think about it between meetings.
So I don't actually know what policy will bring us.
Right.
So, but good thought, and we'll take that into account as we plan both February and May's meetings.
Okay.
Mark, you want to come up and kick off the
Northern Spotted Owl Conservation Advisory Group discussion, please.
Good morning again, Mr. Chair, members of the board. As part of the Northern Spotted Owl Conservation Strategy, the board has asked that each year the board review the need for Spotted Owl Conservation Advisory Group. This group exists to review habitat within the SOCI when a landowner conducts a protocol survey to establish the absence of owls. It's done through the Department of Fish and Wildlife. If they do that and they certify there are no owls in that area, then this group is asked to review that habitat for the need to maintain that habitat, even in the absence of owls. So I don't know if there's more discussion or not, but the to date, the Spotted Owl Conservation Advisory Group has never been convened. But it is a function the board needs to do on an annual basis to maintain the existence of that group if it's needed.
This group came out of a settlement agreement, correct?
I do not know the source of the group.
Board member Sunee.
So I think this was prior to that.
What was it?
There was a series of meetings and subgroup discussions on how the Spotted Owl rule was being implemented, and a report from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and it stimulated discussion by the board in, I think it was 2005, 2006, somewhere around there, about, you know, specific pieces that had been identified as issues in this assessment report that the Department of Fish and Wildlife put out. And full disclosure, I was a co-author of that at the time. And so one of the topics was concern about a disproportionate number of what were called decertification surveys happening inside SOCIs versus outside SOCIs. And so that's where it came from. So this was, I think, pre any litigation. And it was a decision of the board to say, well, let's take a closer look at this and see if this is something that we can kind of get a handle on. And since then, like you said, I don't think there have been any of those surveys submitted to the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I think at the same time, the science behind the protocol changed. And so it used to be that there could be 3 years worth of surveys that indicated lack of occupancy. But some new science showed that sometimes owls come back. And there's also a lack of response by spotted owls in the presence of barred owls, and so the whole survey protocol changed, and so I think it now takes like 5 years to do that. I'm a little bit fuzzy on that, but anyway, I think all of those changes kind of happened at the same time, and I don't know if the 5 years is contributing to the lack of decertification surveys, or if it's just there's no need for them anymore, or it's just not a practice that's been done.
And Mark, who's on the advisory group, please?
I should have anticipated that question. I know that the chair of the board is on the group. I do not remember.
Does he know that?
he does know, because 2 years ago we formally changed and made him a member of the group. But I do not know. I can get that answer.
Okay. All right. So, Patricia, has anybody signed up for public comment on this issue?
No.
Okay, no public comment. So can you, would you like to suggest a motion to the board?
We retain the.
Wow.
We can just.
I don't know whose screen that is.
It's a pretty simple motion.
Yeah.
Board Member Lori.
Sure, thank you. I move Forest Practices Board maintain the Northern Spotted Owl Conservation Advisory.
Second.
Thank you for your second. Any discussion by the board? If no discussion, all in favor, please vote by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion passes. Thank you. Okay, I would suggest we take.
Hey!
I would suggest we take a almost a 15-minute recess till 25 till 30. And take a break before we get into some of our more heavy-duty stuff around water table.
I think he's giving us a 12.
Say we've seen the light, but I don't think that's appropriate.
Is it going to be an early day or late?
I think we'll get through it.
Oh, my God.
You don't remember your password?
I do. I know.
You know, it's interesting.
There, you've seen the light again.
It's not. I'm just making sure. But here, make it there. And then hit the save because it's in my J drive.
So just hit save?
Yeah, when you're done.
Even if they do have that county zoning, you go from management to that super critical area.